Blog Talk Radio.
This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas on Monday, June the 13th. As we like to do on Mondays, we'll be chatting with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. I've got a long list of things to talk to Bill about, but let me begin by saying hello to Bill and asking Bill if he's had an opportunity to see what's coming out of the stock markets, Bill, because it's really bad, Bill.
Well, I'll tell you, Silvio, I don't usually follow the stock market because I think it will give me a heart attack. So I've tried to avoid that. I can tell you what things look like. When I was out this morning doing some business, I saw stores that were far less full than they usually are. I saw a lot of grim looks on people's faces. I saw went by several banks and nobody was going in or out. And I thought it was awfully unusual for a Monday. As far as the markets are concerned, I think that the things that I am looking at rather than stocks, because I don't really follow the stock market, is I'm looking at things like the price of gasoline. Now, I went to the pump this morning, and it was $5.25 here in New York. And there's just an understanding that it's going to go higher and higher and higher. And I don't know how people can take this. I mean, you find middle-class families who may have children of college age or high school. Do they destroy their children's educational plans? What do they give up to pay for all this? And that's what I'm looking at. I'm looking at the overall picture. People say now we have to it's not just a question of whether we take the family out for dinner, but whether we have dinner. I mean, there are people who are skipping meals. There are people who are changing their eating habits. There are people who are giving up needed items for in order to dress their children. This is beginning to look like a very serious recessionary period, and possibly worse. I think that. You know, I think Americans are beginning to understand this is really serious.
That's right. No, I don't follow the markets either, Bill. I'm not one of these people that checks every day either, but I just happened to have seen it a few minutes before we spoke, and I saw the market down 3%, which is a pretty big number.
Yes.
Particularly when you're talking about retirement plans, and this is, of course, a continuation. But I remember I had an old economics professor one time say that the stock market, he once said something like this. He said, don't get hung up on the numbers up and down and stuff like that. Just see it more as a trend, as an indication of confidence, because after all, the market is for people who invest money. So obviously they have to make wise decisions. And that's how I look at it. I mean, everything you said about gasoline and middle class, prices or the middle class and the prices that they're paying is exactly right, because I'm living that. I'm seeing that myself. But this with the market, it's just another, this is just another indication that things are not going well, that the public is very unhappy. And, the stock market is just an indication, Bill. That's why I brought it up. I'm not a specialist in it, and I don't usually talk about the markets on the podcast, but it just seems like one more little thing. It's just one after another. Bad things that are happening, and I agree with you. I don't know where people are going to go. I mean, what they're going to do with their finances, because obviously – if you have a family, and thankfully we don't have, kids in high school or college anymore. We're kind of, you know, on our own, and thankfully, you know, we're okay. I mean, we're not complaining. But there's no question that paying $4.69 for gasoline, which I just did recently, and paying $2.20, that, you know, that difference does impact your budget bill.
Absolutely. And what also I think is bothering people, even if they don't articulate it, is there doesn't seem to be any end to it and any idea of how to end it. I mean, we have a president who goes around saying it's Vladimir Putin's fault. And we have a Congress that is now hung up on an investigation of January 6th and an investigation that is so obviously rigged in advance to produce a certain result. You know, I think that one of the things that happened during the Great Depression is that people began to fear for the future of the country itself, and not just the economic future. We had years during the Depression where America was an out-migration country. More people left than came. And some of those people went back to countries in Europe from which they came and later got caught up in World War II and the Holocaust because they felt America was no longer the land of opportunity. I just wonder when that's going to happen. We had a contributor to Urgent Agenda on our forum send in a question last night saying, sometimes I feel that America is finished and I should really be leaving or thinking of leaving. And do you feel the same way? And we're starting to get some answers back from other readers. But I have never felt in my life the sense of despair about the country that I feel today. And I think, right, as you said, it's every little thing. You turn on a television set and you see a congressional investigation that is conducted the way they do things in third world countries.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, my God, whatever happened to the United States? You,
right,
you see one story after another of criminals committing serious crimes back on the street an hour later, mocking the police. And you don't see an end to it. And, you know, it's,
right,
you know, there is nothing that can destroy a country faster than an abandonment of hope.
Right. No, I think you're exactly right, Bill. Last week I mentioned, and I'll repeat it, that, you know, I've been out with friends here recently. We usually have lunch with friends on Sunday. And that we were out with friends, and a friend of mine said, I don't recognize the country. And they,
yes,
were talking about lots of things. They weren't just talking about inflation. They were talking about a lot of things. And that's kind of the frustration that a lot of people have. You know, it's like, you know, you always think of the United States as the land of hope and opportunity. And it's never been a perfect country, but my goodness, it's pretty good compared to everybody else. And you're right. I mean, there's a sense of despair. You know, I mean, this thing with baby formula, this is the kind of stuff that, if my parents were alive, they would say stuff like, that's what used to happen in Cuba. There would be shortages of baby. And so it's like, it's not supposed to happen in the United States. And yet that's happening in the United States. And that's why people look at it and they go, what's happened to the country? And I guess on the flip side of all of this is a great opportunity for an inspirational leader, sort of the way Reagan did in 81 when he came,
yes,
in, and pick up the country. So that's kind of the, I guess I'm looking forward to that, but my goodness, we still have about 3 years to go. I mean, if this was the Carter administration, Bill, we're still in the spring of 1978, so there's a couple,
that's right,
more years left. I mean, so this is not the, you know, the spring of 1979 or the last year of Carter. This is, we got a lot. We're not even halfway through the Biden,
you know,
administration. It's amazing.
It's interesting you bring that up, because one of the things I want to discuss with my readers in the near future is the notion of a constitutional amendment that would permit, under certain very strict circumstances, an emergency election to replace the president. You know, other countries have it. They have, in parliamentary systems, they have a vote of confidence. And in parliamentary systems, some of them, if you lose the vote of confidence, you leave office that day. And we have no emergency mechanism in this country to remove an administration. We do have, obviously, impeachment. But isn't it interesting that in all of American history, no president has been impeached and removed from office in that mechanism? We have the the 25th Amendment. We have a couple of other things that deal with the health of the president. But we do not have a mechanism which would be employed if conditions get so bad that the continuation of an administration affects the actual existence of the country. And I think we should have that. Normally, I'm opposed to making changes in political procedures. Stability is one of the great things about the United States. But maybe we have become overly stable. And maybe sometimes we need that. I think also that Americans, and I believe this is happening, I think it was reflected in the very low television ratings for the hearing a couple of nights ago. I think Americans have lost faith and are losing faith in the institutions that we depend on, especially the press. I think they are beginning to realize how really corrupt the press is. I mean, the idea of just going along with this, you know, I don't. You want to have a hearing in Congress? Have a hearing. But if you are on the editorial board of the New York Times, you should be the first to say this hearing is corrupt. It is not being conducted like other congressional hearings. It's all one-sided. We don't do that in a democracy. Not one word.
Right. No, I think you're right. You're right about that, and that's been – that is the frustration that I have with this meeting. I have no problem with investigating January the 6th. I mean, we should investigate what happened that day. And I was critical of President Trump when he gave that speech that day. I criticized him before he gave the speech. I thought it was a mistake for him to speak that day. But my goodness, what we're watching, and, you know, it's such a one-sided thing. And for no one in the media to say, look, we'll give you airtime, but you've got to clean up your act. I mean, this, you know, you've got – Bill, the chairman of this committee, Mr. Thompson, did not want to certify Donald Trump in 2016. That is, you know, that's who is in this committee. I mean, that's crazy, Bill.
Absolutely. I mean, and then you have a committee that presumably has two Republicans on it. But in fact, the Republican side wasn't allowed to name its own members, which is unheard of in a Democratic country. It was Nancy Pelosi who picked the members of the committee. And the two Republicans that are on the committee, if you can call them Republicans, are two anti-Trump Republicans. You know, she should have said to the Democratic leader or to the Republican leader, you know, pick five people, and they will be on the committee. That's the way things are done in a truly democratic society. And morale is important in a democracy. Many people underestimate its importance. They think because we have strong institutions that morale isn't important. One of the greatest gifts Ronald Reagan gave to this country is he restored the national morale. And if you don't have national morale in a democracy, that's when you start to drift off into dictatorial procedures.
Well, it happens, Bill. It even happens to people. I mean, when you lose hope yourself and, you know, your self-esteem is down and you don't have, you know, confidence in your future, even as a person, that's when you start getting into bad habits, maybe addictions and so on. So, I mean, the same thing, I suppose, happens to a country, and we are there now. But one thing I wanted to point out, I just saw this morning, Rasmussen reports. And, I mean, this is only one poll. I mean, I'm sure there's others out there, but they're pretty close as far as the numbers. They show President Biden today with 38% approval, 38%. Mm. Now, that's pretty consistent with some of the others in the high 30s. In fact, the average, this is remarkable. I've never seen this before. The average of the last 10 or 11 has President Biden, when you do the average, that is, of all the polls, under 40% at 38 or 39. I don't know how you can get anything done with numbers like that. And then when you combine it with the way he looks in public and how out of touch he seems to be with everything, you know, that's why your idea of a special emergency election looks better and better to me all the time, Bill. Now, you would need an amendment to the Constitution, I guess, in order to do that.
Yes.
You know, that might take longer than – that might take a few years for that to happen, but I think you're right. I mean, there's just a sense in the country that things are the airplane is just sort of bouncing up in the air, and that the pilot doesn't know what he's doing, Bill.
I think that's absolutely correct. And once again, we come to the behavior of the American press. You know, I think that it is true that a free press is necessary for the proper functioning of a democracy. But if a free press can save a country, it can also destroy it. And we are not yet fully aware of the destructive abilities of a nation's press when the great majority of them, I think polls show 90% of all the reporters in Washington are liberals, that when the press goes off the rails. Now, I think it was partially off the rails before. I thought during the Vietnam War, certain procedures and ideas began to enter into the profession or business of journalism. It's not a profession. It's a business of journalism. And I think we just hoped they would go away. Well, I think they have come roaring back. And one of those ideas is that the purpose of the press is not to report the news, but to improve the society. It's not to improve the society. It's, Arthur Hayes Sulzberger, a man I didn't particularly care for, who was publisher of the New York Times, but he said one thing that was true. He said, "We'll tell you which way the cat is jumping. It's up to the public to take care of the cat." And that's true. Mm-hmm. It is up to the public to use information and to solve the problems of the country. It is not up to the press to report the news with the idea that we can shift public opinion simply by the stories we pick, because that's not legit.
Right. Well, and if you – I didn't watch all the – in fact, I did not want to watch all the Sunday shows this weekend because they were all obsessed with this committee, and there wasn't anybody that I saw in the media who was willing to bring up this point of balance. The only person who brought it up was Jonathan Turley, Professor Turley,
yes,
who wrote an excellent article about this. And even Alan Dershowitz, who did not vote for President Trump, he was also upset about the lack of balance. I mean, it seems to me that if the objective here is to get Trump, they're not going to get him doing stuff like this. I mean, because I think the public, like you say, looks at this investigation and goes, this is not real. These people are not being fair and balanced. And that's probably – I think you lose a lot of Americans when you're not fair and balanced. I know that I'm using a Fox News line, but I, just in general, generically, if you're not fair and balanced, I think you lose people, Bill.
Well, I think you do, because the people are always ahead of the press. Have you noticed that? They always instinctively mm-hmm. know that something is wrong. I think, for example, that during the Vietnam War, I once was having lunch with a very distinguished lawyer who during the Vietnam War was a carrier pilot and flew missions over Vietnam. And he said the war we were fighting was not the one we were reading about in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that idea was not unique to him. It's something we heard during the war. And yet nothing was done. We have no mechanism in journalism, which calls itself a profession but isn't. We have no mechanism for there to be an inquiry by a professional association to say, you know, is there something wrong? Is there something basically wrong? I think it's needed. During the Vietnam War, there was a proposal made for a national news council where people could go, ordinary citizens could go, if they felt they had been hurt by the press, and they could get a judgment. But the New York Times destroyed that. But I think that idea is going to come back. We need some independent mechanism. We talk about freedom of the press. We don't realize that the First Amendment, which guarantees freedom of the press, was written before the age of electricity. There is no way the founders of this country could have predicted what we call the press today, these huge conglomerates, which are impossible to sue, impossible to go up against, and their existence violates one of the fundamental understandings of the authors of the Constitution, which is checks and balances. They would never have allowed this to go on. We are in need of a better press in America, as we've been in need of it before, but now I think more than ever.
That's right. No, I think the media. I mean, what the media has shown me during these hearings, or I guess there's one today. Nobody will watch the one today. I mean, less than 20 million people watched this thing the other night, Bill, and it was for free in most of the networks. You didn't even have to have cable to watch it.
Yes.
And they got 20 million people. I mean, that's not exactly very encouraging, but nobody in the press stood up and say, hey, you know, this is a circus. You know, you got to have balance here. And, you know,
that's
when
right.
you show these videos, you know, when you show these videos of the Attorney General and the president's daughter, Ivanka Trump, I mean, those are highly edited, selective videos. that would not survive in a regular trial, Bill. If this was a real trial, the judge would stop that immediately and say, you know, you can't do that. Well, the defense lawyer would probably do it as well, Bill.
Yes, sir.
And stop it. So that's the thing, that there's so much, there's such a lack of due process here that it just scares the heck out of you. That the Democrats are doing it, Bill, I understand. I mean, what else do they have? But that the media would go along with it, that is a real disappointment to me, Bill.
It is. And, you know, I was thinking this morning, we now have all these little gimmicks in our home, cable television and satellite television and all that other stuff. But the fact is that the big three television networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, still operate as over-the-air carriers, which means they are subject to the Federal Communications Act of 1932 or 1933, which specifies that they are to operate in the public interest. And once again, I find disappointing the Republican Party, which engages in these half fights. They never go out and land a punch. If I were the chairman of the Republican National Committee, I would send messages to each of those networks saying, in our view, you are not operating in the national interest by just covering these things and covering up the really almost dictatorial unfairness. And we believe there should be an investigation to see whether you keep your license. I mean, it's time to talk to them in blunt terms that they have responsibilities here under law. These are federally mandated operations, the big three television networks. The cable systems are not. They are mm-hmm. not covered by federal law. But, you know, these things have come up before. There used to be something called the Fairness Doctrine. I'm sure you remember it, where television networks, radio networks, operating under the Federal Communications Act were required to give equal time in political mm-hmm. discussions to the opponent. It was abolished. I don't recall when. I think it was during the Reagan administration. The feeling was there were now so many outlets that it was no longer needed. But I think it is needed again for the big three, and it should be suggested again. At times, you got to scare these guys. And mm-hmm. the Republican response to this unfairness has been anemic, which is my right. great fear about the fall also, that with all the good news coming the Republicans' way in terms of polls, that they will get very soft in running the election and will get punched. And unfortunately, it's a history of the party.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, you're right. I just hope that that there's a lot of people across the country, a lot of people, candidates running, who will stand up. But I'll say one last thing about the media, Bill. This is kind of funny. One of the companies that distributes newspapers, I think it's called the Gannett Organization. I think that's the
yes.
name of it. That they're doing away with editorials and opinion from their newspapers because they say people are sick and tired of reading from people that they don't think know anything about the topic they're writing about. And I just think that's kind of hilarious. That Americans are saying, hey, I don't want to read opinion anymore. I mean, just give me the news. Now, sometimes it gets confusing. But I just thought it was hilarious that, you know, one of the people representing the company say that we lose a lot of subscriptions because of our editorials. Well, yeah, I mean, that's what happened here to the Dallas Morning News when they endorsed Beto O'Rourke in 2018, Bill. They lost a ton
yes.
of subscriptions. I almost
yeah.
canceled mine. I mean, just because people were so angry at that. Well, hopefully, you know, I don't know how many other organizations will imitate Gannett. I don't know. I'm not familiar with the business, but I just thought it was kind of a funny way of explaining why they're going to change their business model, Bill. I just thought it was kind of funny. But I do want to go to New York, Bill, because there's a couple of big things coming out of New York that I want to get your feedback on. Number one, the mayor is losing a lot of support. The mayor Adams, he's losing support. I just looked at a survey that shows that there's great dissatisfaction with him in New York. And at the same time, police officers are leaving the force in huge numbers. How does Mayor Adams get this back together, Bill? Because there was so much anticipation, so much hope, and here we are in the middle of June. And it all seems to be flying away, Bill.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. When he came in with very little public enthusiasm for him. I mean, there was no great wanting of Eric Adams. You didn't see the people in the press running out in the middle of the street threatening to kill themselves if Adams wasn't elected. But once he was elected, there was some guarded optimism that as a former police officer, he was police captain, that he would understand the situation and do something about it. And indeed, some of his public statements have been wonderful. They really have been wonderful. He issued one a couple of weeks ago that was superb, in which he severely criticized the judges and the district attorneys who let people back on the street after they commit serious crimes. And we thought, well, now, you know, maybe now he's going to begin to fight. But people who are knowledgeable say he is boxed in. In order for him to be effective, he has to get changes in laws. And those laws are controlled by the New York State Legislature, which is second only to the Kremlin in its love of the political left. I mean, you feel that if they could, they would elect Joe Stalin as the majority leader. I mean, right. These are really hard leftists. And I'll give you another example: the New York City Council, right here in New York, they meet five blocks from Ground Zero, and they have the Progressive Caucus in the New York City Council has just hired as its organizer, the person who's going to organize the progressives, one of the most extreme left-wing political operators in New York. They learn nothing. Is that the political left never learns anything because it sees itself not as a group of political figures, but as saviors of the country. They really see themselves as a kind of a religious movement, where even if they're defeated and the people tell them, we do not want your ideas, they say, oh, this is only temporary, and as godlike figures, we have to go on and continue doing the same thing. And so the mayor is boxed in, but even being boxed in, if he is, he has to go to the people and say, we have a city emergency, and do everything he possibly can within his powers to end that emergency. If it means diverting people from other city jobs to not to law enforcement, but to desk jobs, which will free more police officers, let them do it. The powers of the mayor are limited, but those powers can be expanded if enough pressure is put on the governor and New York State, but he hasn't tried to organize that yet. Also, I think that he has... You know, we had a mayor named David Dinkins. He was the first black mayor of New York, and a more decent man you couldn't find. He was a very fine man. He came into office with so much hope, and it was pretty obvious very quickly that he was captured by the black establishment. And instead of being what he wanted to be, a mayor who happened to be black, he called New York the gorgeous mosaic. He became, quote, the black mayor, and it was obvious that they had gotten to him. I think this may be happening here as well. Adams is now speaking, by the way, quite seriously and openly about running for president in 2024. And I think people are saying, is he delusional? On the basis of what? On the basis of what? But I think it's possible that he has been reached by certain people and say, you go along with us and not correct these horrible things that are wrong. Just go along with them for a while, and we will back you in a run for the presidency. These things happen in politics. They're dirty, they're ugly, but they do happen. But the mayor does not seem to be effective, which is the word you want, really, in a situation like this.
That's right.
And
no,
New York
it,
City...
No, go ahead.
And the city is in terrible
condition.
It
is. I mean, all you have to do is talk to anybody who lives there. I mean, the city is just, as you say, he's not doing a very effective job. Which is what he was. What I thought he would do. See, I had my hopes that maybe Eric Adams was the new Democrat, or at least the beginning of something new. But so far, that has not happened. We're going to take a little break, Bill, and we'll be back in a few minutes with more of the Week in Review with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Virgin Agenda. Bill, I'll just take a quick second and maybe remind you that yesterday, Sunday, was the 35th anniversary of Tear Down This Wall, Mr. Gorbachev, one of the great speeches. I'm sure you remember that speech, Bill.
Oh, very much so. It was the
yes.
defining line of the Reagan administration. And it's interesting, there's a story behind that line. It was written into the president's speech that he was going to give at the Brandenburg Gate. And I believe it was actually written by Peggy Noonan. And the State Department objected very strongly to it. And I believe Colin Powell, who had, I don't recall exactly what his position was at that moment, objected very strongly. They felt it was belligerent, that it was inappropriate for a president. And Peggy Noonan sat down with the president and said, you know, Mr. President, we have all this objection to this line, and maybe we ought to change it. And he said, and I think something memorable, that's why we were elected. In other words, that idea is why we were elected. It's a wonderful lesson in politics. Reagan understood why he was elected by the American people. The line stayed in. It became the most famous line of his administration and really defined his foreign policy. And
that's
right.
Course, and
what is also interesting is that the wall did come down.
That's right. And I was just thinking that maybe Mayor Eric Adams should learn from what President Reagan, from the story that you just related about President Reagan, that sometimes you have to go against the so-called experts and, you know, let your gut feeling prevail. And that's what happened with Reagan. That was Reagan being Reagan, as they used to say. That was Reagan being Reagan, you know, as they used to say. But, yeah, 35 years ago, Bill, that is remarkable. I remember watching it with Peter Jennings on ABC. And our son had just been born. That's what I remember. I was holding our son, who was maybe 3 weeks old, maybe 2 weeks old. And I was holding him, and I was watching Peter Jennings of ABC when this, you know, when I learned about the speech. And it was a great moment for me. And I always tell my son, you know, I was holding you when I heard that speech. He gets a kick out of that, Bill.
Well, it's, you know, it is the thing that there's a moment sometimes in an administration that is a magic, that is a magic moment. I think that when President Roosevelt was elected and inaugurated, the line in his inaugural address, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself," was one of those magic moments that people will remember. I think that during World War II, the great lines written by Winston Churchill, which, by the way, were often delivered in the middle of an otherwise not very great speech. He would make these speeches to Parliament reporting on the progress of the war. Some of them were actually very mechanical, but then he would throw in a line like, this was their finest hour, or we shall fight them on the beaches, we shall fight them on the landing fields, we shall never surrender, or never before in the time of human conflict has so much owed by so many to so few. And these became defining moments of an administration. One of the things we really lack today in America is a great speaker, a speaker who could not only deliver the speech well, but can write it well in such a way that we remember it. I have not heard a memorable speech in American politics since, well, I guess it would be the Reagan administration. I mean,
I think you're right. I mean, I do remember, in all fairness, I thought President Bush, the second President Bush, was pretty eloquent, you know, right after 9/11 when he said, you know, the people who did this are going to hear all of us soon, you know, that line.
Yes.
I thought that was the kind of line that stuck with people, you know, it was memorable because people said, we couldn't hear you, we cannot hear you. And then he said, I can hear you. And you know, you remember that, and the people who did this are going to hear all
absolutely.
Of us soon. That was a great
line,
and that was completely natural. That was actually not
yes.
part of the script. So I thought that was a great moment like that. But anyway, 35 years ago, hard to believe. Well, let's talk a little
yes.
bit. You wrote a great article today, Bill, about Selena Zito, and I had seen that article myself before, where she, like you say in your post, she actually gets down in the streets and talks to voters, which is a rare thing to do in the media today, because sometimes you get the impression that the people in the newsroom just sit there and read what's on the computer, or simply tell us what the polling data is. You don't get the feeling that a lot of reporters are doing what she does, which is to actually go out and talk to people. And I thought that article she wrote about Ohio and your analysis of it, Bill, was absolutely great. So please share that with us.
Well, Selena Cito is, as I think I wrote in the piece, probably the best political reporter in America today, because she does go out and she talks to people who actually work for a living and vote on Election Day. And you have a press, especially in the big capital cities of America, the Los Angeles, New York, Washington, that, as you just implied, is completely distant from their country. They don't seem to know much about it. And what's worse, they don't seem to care that they don't know. I've heard the phrase many times in my career, the flyover people. In Hollywood, where I spent some days of imprisonment or years of imprisonment, people would refer to the flyover people. Those are those people in the middle of the country, so sad they didn't go to an Ivy League school. And what could they possibly know? What could they possibly know? But I think it is an attitude that has dominated journalism. For example, I'll just give you a perfect example. You and I have been discussing, I think, for a year, and it was a subject you introduced on one of these broadcasts, of the political changes in the Hispanic community. And you talked about generational change, the ideas of the immigrant generation are replaced by the ideas of the second generation. And yet when the subject of political change within the Hispanic community comes up, they all sit there at their desks shocked that Hispanics are moving to the right. It didn't surprise you, and you're knowledgeable because you talk to people. Mm-hmm. I think that they're going to be equally surprised when they find that the Asian American community is moving to the right, because they're fed up with the way they're treated. And
yes,
these are groups that are in the Democratic Party base. And yet, if they would go out and actually talk to people, they would find the reasons for these changes. But they don't, and I don't see any improvement.
No, and I don't know if it's the way with their – you know this better than me, because you actually worked in a newspaper. I mean, I've never worked in a newspaper, but I don't know – you know, I don't know that if at one time when a newspaper reporter was hired – if he was sort of given a book and said, now go out and cover whatever street you're covering. Now it seems like they come in and they sit at a desk. You know, that's kind of the impression I get. And,
yes,
and so you don't have that. And also, I don't think one of these Ivy League schools guys is going to be able to, you know, like if he walked into what is that where they have the military offices, not the offices, but where military guys get together, DFW, is it, or – The veterans are for VFW.
Yes, the American Legion halls.
Exactly,
American Legion halls.
I think that back in the 1950s or 1960s, that a reporter who maybe served in the military, World War II or Korea, could actually walk into those meetings and have a beer with one of those guys and relate to them. I don't think a lot of the people today who work in newsrooms have that ability to relate to them. I mean, they don't even know what are they going to talk about. You know, what are they going to talk about? That they seem to be so disconnected on values, Bill. Just values alone, they seem to be so disconnected, Bill.
Well, absolutely, because I think this is the curse of the college education. We turned the college education into a cult-like object where you had to, quote, go to college. And people who went to college and got their degree in certain circumstances and in certain parts of the country and in certain social classes began to feel superior to the rest of the country. I mean, who are those people out there who dare to vote in an election and have the same one vote that I have? Why shouldn't I have 10 votes? Why, I went to Dartmouth. And that attitude really is very much present, very much present. You know, you wonder what kind of conversations go on in Washington, Washington being a city completely untypical of the United States, and why reporters aren't sent out more on the road. There was an on-the-road series that CBS did with Charles Kuralt,
Yes.
Many years ago, Charles Kuralt is, of course, deceased. But I knew Charles Kuralt, and I once asked him back in the early 70s, of all the things you learned in going around the country these years in the On the Road series, what is the most important? And without any hesitation, he said, I am always amazed at how well-informed Americans are. Now,
right.
I think he was right. I don't know if that would be true today, but he was right. Americans have a kind of folk wisdom, and they do listen. They listen much more than people think, and they do know what's going on in the world. Even then, if you saw a polling, tracking polls during an election campaign, as soon as anything important happened, you would see the polls change. And they never asked the question, what is making these polls change? Who is listening? What do they think? Doris Kearns Goodwin wrote a book about the Roosevelt administration, and she said, in those days we only had radio, she said, when the president gave an important speech, you could walk down the streets of an American city in the summer, because all the windows were open, people didn't have air conditioning, and you could hear the whole speech just by walking down the block because every radio was on. Americans are interested. They're not stupid. They're not uninvolved.
Right.
They are very concerned about their country, and even someone on the air this morning said they're concerned about the future of their country, not just the economy. And I don't think that the people in the press register that at all.
No, not at all. In fact, I think it was Newt Gingrich this morning who said that that his organization, I guess I'm not sure what the name of it is, took a poll or did a survey with Americans, and something like 87% of people want the country to work. They're not necessarily ideological ideas, or they're liberal or conservative. They just want the country to work. They want to be able to put gasoline at a reasonable price. They want to be able to buy baby formula, stuff like that, like we were talking about at the beginning of the podcast. They want the country to work, and these are practical people. They're out there raising families, running businesses. They don't have a lot of time for AOC ideology, but they're very practical people. And for some reason, those are the people who I think she was talking about in that article, Bill, that are saying, I don't recognize the country. I keep going back to that example, but I think that's what she was saying in that article, Bill.
Yes, it was. And I think she was also saying as to why Trump was so popular in certain areas, whether you like him or not. And I think we both have talked about his sometimes rather abrasive personality, but they liked Trump as a president because they knew that he understood them. Again, I'm going to quote a rather famous line from Doris Kearns Goodwin, who related the story of the day that President Roosevelt died. A reporter saw a soldier at the White House gate just standing there and crying. And the reporter went up to him, and he thought maybe he was a member of the president's military staff or something. And he said, "Did you know him?" And the soldier said, "No, but he knew me." That's a very important line in politics. And they felt that Trump knew them. And he did, because people here in New York know that Trump was famous for having lunch not with executives but with the hard hats, with the people who actually built his buildings. And he got to know what they were like and what their concerns were. And so when he spoke to them, he could speak in a way in their language, and they appreciated it. And when he came to office, he did what he promised to do. He renegotiated trade treaties that were hurting American workers, and they were appreciative. And you have a situation now where there are whole sections of Ohio, which is where Selena Zito was when she did this story, that are different from what they used to be politically because of changes in the United States. You'd never know it listening to the Washington journalists. I mean, they just seem totally oblivious.
Well, it's the same thing happening in South Texas, Bill, with the political shift in South Texas. I mean, there's a special election this week in South Texas to replace a congressman who's retiring or leaving for whatever reason, I forgot. Very likely a Republican lady is going to win that. And that's an earthquake in South Texas. That does not happen. But it's all part of the shifting winds going on in South Texas, in Ohio, and many of these other places. Let me go. I got a few other topics here I wanted to touch on. There appears to be a deal, Bill, some kind of an understanding. I'm not sure how much of a deal it is, but it's an understanding with gun control. Now, I have not seen it because it actually has not been written yet, but I think it focuses on school safety and on background checks. I don't have a problem if that's what it is, Bill, because obviously school safety is critical and background checks are critical. But what's really critical to me, Bill, is that we put in the background check what's going on with this person, because we didn't in the case of the young man in Texas or the young man in Buffalo. It seems like when they both went to buy a gun, they should have been refused because of their background, Bill, but they were not.
Absolutely.
Something went wrong. Something went wrong there, Bill.
Well, it did go wrong, and I think that it would be nice if the press would occasionally go into at least the second layer of a story, and they would find that some of the things that have gone wrong in the background check system were not the fault of gun owners or the NRA or gun nuts, but were the fault of liberals. I recall that when Congresswoman Giffords was so horribly shot in Arizona, the person who was the perpetrator should never have been allowed to buy a gun because he had a mental health history. But it turned out that history was not permitted to be in the information in the background check file or whatever they call it in Washington, because psychiatrists, the psychiatric profession, didn't want it there. They felt that if it was there, it would discourage people from getting the help they needed. Now, that might be true, but let's go into that and find out how we can solve that problem. Nobody asked any questions.
Right. Well, the same thing, Bill, happened in South Texas about 5 years ago, where a guy showed up and started shooting at a small town church there near San Antonio. And he was shooting like crazy. And then eventually somebody went out to his car and pulled out a gun and killed him. But there again, that young man was a Air Force veteran with all kinds of mental health issues. He should have never been able to buy a gun, and yet the information, again, was not put in the background. So if we're going to do background checks, I'm all for that, but let's make sure we put the information in there so that the people who are selling the guns at least have a chance to reject the sale, Bill.
That's exactly right. And what's interesting, when this series of events occurred, these shootings occurred, I did check around to see if anybody around the world had done a good job of dealing with the issue, because sometimes they will do a good job in one area. For example, it's been pointed out there that gun ownership is not permitted in Japan. You cannot buy a gun in Japan, and it's been pointed to by people who want restrictions in the United States because there are no or very few gun deaths in Japan. But it is also true that Japan has the second highest suicide rate in the developed world. And I think somebody ought to look at that and look at those two things together. I don't know if they're related, but it's a fascinating set of circumstances. Also, a country that has had a fear of terrorist attacks, Israel, began to look at the United States in terms not of political terror attacks, but of these shootings in schools. They were concerned about their schools. Could that happen in Israel? And they studied each thing that had been suggested in the United States, and they started to apply things to their own schools. And this is what they found. Every school in Israel has armed guards.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the system, and every child knows that those police officers are there to help them, to protect them. There's no trauma on the part of kids seeing cops with guns. I see them every day anyway. Just go outside. But the second area that they looked into, which is absolutely fascinating, they said that the most important thing was mental health and that they go after it. They do it proactively. In every school, there are counselors, and the principal of the school is responsible for the mental health activities in that school. And if a youngster starts to misbehave, they immediately assign a trained person, not simply to the youngster, but to the youngster's family. And they start looking into the background, and they have been able to detect a number of situations where action had to be taken.
That's right. No, I think it's all a matter of supervision. And, of course, it all begins at the home. Unfortunately, many of these young men do not have a man in their lives, or a father, that is, in their lives. In the case of the young man in Texas, he didn't have a mother either. I mean, this is a a terrible situation. This young man, his father and mother were completely on their own, and he was, I guess, growing up with his grandmother. But what a terrible thing. Bill, we should be expecting the Roe v. Wade, not the Roe v. Wade, but the abortion decision, I guess, any day this month, I guess. It could be tomorrow.
Yes.
And a couple of quick things I wanted to bring up. Apparently, there's people already outside protesting, and I guess they have the right to protest, but I'm not sure they have the right to keep the justices from going into the building or to keep the justices safe at their home, Bill. I mean, it seems like this has all gone crazy here with these protesters threatening to kill justices. And I think the most obnoxious thing of all, somebody apparently published the names of the schools where one of the justices' kids go to. And these are kids these are young kids, Bill, seventh,
that's
eighth
right.
grade kids. I mean, that's awful. Somebody should go to jail for doing stuff like that, Bill.
Well, they should, because it's actually prohibited by law, by federal law, but the Attorney General of the United States will not enforce the law. It is not permissible under federal law to picket a judge's home if with the intent of trying to change that judge's opinion. And that is exactly what they're doing. They should be stopped. The judge you're referring to, by the way, was Amy Comey Barrett, who somebody published the names of the schools that her children go to. Absolutely outrageous. The Attorney General should be impeached and removed if he will not enforce the law. We could be looking at a terrible tragedy. The decision is going to be handed down. Apparently, they have until early July, according to the court calendar, to hand it down. I believe all decisions are handed down on Monday, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
I was always under the impression that it was in the month of June, but I could be wrong. You know, in the past, they had always been, like you say, on a Monday. So I guess if that's the case, it'll be next Monday. But this is such an opportunity for President Biden to step out of the box or whatever the expression is, and give a speech saying, no, we're not going to tolerate you doing this. And if you publish the name of the school of a justice, we're going to arrest you for doing that. But again, you know, he's out there blaming this, I guess, on Putin or Exxon profits. I guess that's the other thing going around these days. So, I mean,
standard
it's sad.
Democratic Party stuff, yeah.
Yeah, but it's sad because you're right about the Attorney General. This Attorney General, again, it's just very sad. The whole state of this administration is just really very sad, Bill.
Well, that's right. I mean, the thing that you just mentioned, he's now blaming the oil companies the enormously high prices. Somebody should point out to him, 2 years ago, the prices were half of what they are now. It was the same companies, you know? I mean, did they finally get around to gouging the customer? They do gouge the customers sometimes, but this is not one of those occasions. This is being caused by external things, especially that ridiculous act when he became president on his first day of banning fracking, of really attacking the energy industry. I just got, by the way, a notice just before we went on the air from my electric company that my rates are going up 16%.
Wow.
And, you know,
that's pretty incredible.
A big increase.
Right. No, that is. And wait until that hits us here in Texas with the summer coming up, Bill.
That's exactly right, and they're calling it the – they all have a gimmick.
Right.
You know, it's the summer rate increase. I don't
right.
think it's going to be any less in the fall, but they call it the summer. Now, I don't know who they're blaming. It may not be Putin. It might be the local dentist. Maybe they're using too much electricity. They'll find somebody.
Well, they'll blame it on the Yankees, Bill. The Yankees are playing too many games at night, so they're using much electricity. That's what they'll blame it on the Yankees and the Mets or something like that. But yeah, it is incredible. Bill, as always, the time flies. I want to thank you so much for joining us and for giving us your input. Keep up the great work at Urgent Agenda, and I love your articles about Selena Zito when you write those. They're absolutely great. I agree with you. She's a real treasure, Bill. She's a real treasure. I wish we had more ladies like that, or men like that, frankly, in the profession. Have a great day, Bill.
Thank you.
You have a great day. I was going to say something about the Yankees, but I forgot you don't cheer for them. Your team, you don't cheer.
That's all right.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Well, the Yankees are having a great year. That's why I said
that. They are, yes. And we allow them to use our roads.
Okay. All right, Bill. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you later.
Looking forward to it, Sylvia.
All right, bye-bye. Our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Addenda. Of course, Bill used to be a Brooklyn Dodgers fan. And so we can forgive him for what he said about the Yankees. Have a wonderful day, everybody. We'll talk to you later. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.